and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology.
Jennifer Klein is Professor of History at Yale University. In August 2012, we spoke about her new book, written with Eileen Boris, Caring for America, Home Healthcare Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State.
How does the history of home healthcare illustrate the history of the U.S. public-private welfare state?
For so long, the labor of care was thought of as marginal to what defines an economy or what even defines the center of public policy. And so one of the things that we've tried to do in this book is to look at the American welfare state from the perspective of care, but more specifically from the perspective of care work. What does it actually mean to bring the workers into the picture? And when we think of the welfare state, we often think of it as income transfer programs, welfare programs that somehow transfer money to people. But we rarely think about the fact that the state has to actually configure a labor market to carry out these processes. And that's what it does in the case of care. It created the actual labor market. Now, in order to carry out these functions, the state has relied on a whole range of agencies, on private charities, on public hospitals, on private hospitals, on state departments of public health, on, you know, the vast apparatus. And so this enables us to see all the connections that actually make the welfare state function.
Can you talk a little bit about the dual rehabilitation discourse that emerges out of social policy?
When we talk about the New Deal, we always have to think about the tensions that are in it, the tensions of liberalism. And one of these tensions, of course, took place in terms of the New Deal, on the one hand, creating a new value on economic security and really placing an emphasis on new rights to economic security, which we see through things like the Social Security Act and support for home ownership and labor rights and minimum wage and the Fair Labor Standards Act. So I think economic security and the notion of security is really central to the New Deal. At the same time, the notion of independence is always still there. And so much of what defines liberal citizenship in the United States. The New Deal also had this idea of rehabilitation, which you see in different kinds of programs. It's there in agricultural programs, for example, rehabilitation of the land, but also rehabilitation of poor farmers. Right. It's a fusing of economic and social meanings of rehabilitation. And the same thing happened in terms of how it approached welfare and work relief. The fusing of the notions of independence and rehabilitation. And I think this carries forward particularly as the U.S. moved into the 1940s and into the post-war period. Home care, as we see it in our book, really begins during the Works Progress Administration of the WPA, where the state initially stepped in for two reasons. One, to help women who were mothers who were somehow incapacitated, either because they were in the hospital or they were ill or couldn't take care of their children. And so the state would actually send in a substitute mother to take care of the children.
They were called substitute mothers too, right?
Right. Yeah. And the other way in which the WPA intervened was through a chronic illness project to help people move out of the hospital who had been there and to move home. And the WPA programs in particular targeted poor African-American women, particularly unemployed domestics, to be the caretakers who would work through these WPA programs. And increasingly what developed was this ideology of rehabilitation. And moving into the 1940s, the administrators of these programs would talk about how, well, if we could help the elderly and the chronically ill, because it was increasingly about care of the elderly as well, if we could help the elderly and the disabled, stay at home and not be in institutions, then this would reduce their dependence on the state. They would become independent, which means becoming a good citizen. Right. And if somebody came in and took care of them, it would rehabilitate them. At the same time, administrators of these programs looked at poor women on public assistance and said, oh, well, if we can push them into jobs of wage work, then this would end their dependence on the state and make them, quote, independent. And if they took care of other people, rehabilitating other people, it would allegedly rehabilitate them as mothers and family caretakers. And this is how they looked at primarily the African-American women who did the job. And so you get this concept of dual rehabilitation. And it becomes so deeply ideologically embedded that in every era, the policymakers and the welfare administrators never shake their faith in this. They would identify women who are on public assistance. They continually saw them as the ready supply of labor for these jobs and believed in the notion that if they just would push them into these jobs, it would end their dependence on the state and rehabilitate them. The thing we have to keep in mind, though, is because these jobs from the moment of the WPA were called homemaker services or housekeeper services, that meant they were classified in law as domestic service and therefore outside of all New Deal labor standards. They were not included in any New Deal labor law. They were not included in fair labor standards. That means they were not included in minimum wage or overtime compensation. So the idea that these women were somehow going to end their poverty and end their dependence by going into jobs that didn't even qualify for the minimum wage was obviously preposterous. And yet the policymakers never shake their faith in this. This continues in the 1950s. It continued in the war on poverty. It was there in the 1970s with CETA, the Comprehensive Employment Training Program. It was there through workfare in the 1980s and 1990s. Policymakers never shook their faith that poor women of color would be rehabilitated through new jobs in domestic service, which basically were the same as their old jobs.
How is the employer-employee relationship mystified by the state and private vendors in the home care market?
We're talking about home attendants who do the work of helping people get out of bed, bathing, getting dressed, cooking their meals, eating, helping them get around, domestic tasks. And so these are often assumed to be the tasks that should just be unpaid. They should be done by wives or daughters or mothers out of love, out of duty, out of obligation. Right. And so to begin with, there is an assumption that why would this even be considered paid work? The second thing is the realm of the home, which is, you know, considered this insulated realm that the state doesn't penetrate or that somehow the market doesn't penetrate, as if there hasn't been waged labor in the home or exploited labor in the home for, you know, quite a long time, for centuries. And but we have legal rulings dating back a century cutting off the home in that sense. The other thing is, of course, the question of who does it. We always have to remember the racial division of labor. And particularly that we're talking about labor that had traditionally been done either by slaves, by servants who were people of color, by immigrants, and of course by women. But the dimension we really wanted to add to this story was that the other factor here is the way that the state also structures it. The state has continued to obscure who is the real employer of the workers, who actually employs the workers. And in labor history, you know, traditionally labor history has looked at industrial workers or farm workers, where you can see there's a clear mass group of workers and there's a boss. And writing about the service sector, you also have to think about the fact that there is a customer or a consumer, and that complicates the relationship. With home care, there's also the family. and then there's the state. So there are multiple parties involved in this. And the state itself continually wants to actually distance any public agencies from actually appearing to be the employer. And so they've come up with all kinds of mechanisms to make it look as though the client is really the employer. So, for example, they would issue a dual check, which meant that the check would actually go to the client first, and then the worker would be paid from that.
Public sector unionism and home care work are fundamentally tied together, and you bring that out so well when you discuss the cuts that Christie and even Cuomo and the various other governors are kind of imposing on both their public sector workers and on home care work as well.
I know, we thought if we had actually finished the book a few years earlier, as we had originally intended, we would have had such a more optimistic story. Because, in fact, the workers had succeeded in unionizing. They had waged this long struggle to unionize. And one of their strategies was to get some kind of recognition as public workers, or at least workers doing the public labor of the welfare state. And they felt that if they could take this labor out of the stigmatized realm of the home and the legally excluded and devalued realm of the home and project it into the welfare state and use that as their terrain of social struggle and get themselves recognized as public workers, that this would be an enormous achievement that could really raise the level of compensation and the value of what they do. And at the very moment that they succeed, in fact, in getting this recognition, public workers become the most vilified workers in America. And you see them attacked directly in states such as Wisconsin and New Jersey, where I think, in fact, the assault on home care workers really became an opening wedge for a much wider assault on the collective bargaining rights of public workers in general. And why do they want to do this? Think of all the workers they're attacking. I mean, they are home care workers, they are child care workers, they are nurses, social workers, teachers, all the people who do human services. And they're also the workers who defend the social budget. That is what public sector unions do. And so they want to eviscerate not only the economic security of these workers and their ability to bargain for their own benefits, but they want to eviscerate the one collective voice that is actually able to stand up strong for the social budget.
Can you define that term, the social budget? What do you mean by that?
I mean the budget that goes into education, healthcare, public services, all the things like public libraries and parks, all the things that actually make our lives good and that, you know, middle-class folks need, that working-class folks need, and that poor people need. The social budget.
Thank you, Professor Jennifer Klein. Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production.
This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by SAGE. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.